Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. For more information, visit korin.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. This week, we're looking at the way labels shape our perspectives on food.
I know you're not supposed to judge a book by its cover, but is it acceptable to judge a wine by its label?
There are some labels that I'd say are so bad they're good.
As long as your paperwork's in good shape, you'll get a grass-fed label.
Tune in to this week's Meat and Three on Heritage Radio Network. That's Meat plus sign THREE. Available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hello, welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Tema, food writer and the director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deeper understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from our studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every day in the supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, so I'll try to demystify it in this program with my good guests. And my guest today is Andrew Richardson, who has worked at the World Sake Imports, which is one of the best sake importers in the U.S. for the last 11 years. And he also worked at the legendary New American restaurant, WD50, and created very interesting sake pairing menus for Riley Different. And I'm always impressed by Andrew's experience and tremendous knowledge of sake. So we'll discuss how he encountered with sake, how he got involved in the sake industry at this deep level, and his favorite sake breweries, and much, much more. But before we start, Japan Eats is available on the Heritage Radio Network website, as well as on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. So please go to iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify, and subscribe to Japan Eats. And please write a review. We'd appreciate your feedback. Also, if you have any ideas about topics of the show or show guests, please let us know. You can email us at japanneeds@heritageradionetwork.org or akikotema.com. And I have a quick announcement about the fun event. The 23rd Sumo Stew is coming to New York on Monday, November 12th at 8 p.m. at Brooklyn Brewery in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And as you may know, Sumo Stew is a seasonal live streaming event of sumo matches straight from Japan, and you can enjoy Japanese food from outstanding restaurants as you watch the fun matches. And its matches are very captivating if you know sumo. So tickets are available at eventbrite.com and search for Sumo Stew. Again, it's eventbrite.com and search for Sumo Stew. And this is the discount code for Japanese listeners. It's $10 off, and the code is WSSJapanEats. One word, SS Japanese, WS Japanese. So please, I hope to see you there. And let's start a conversation with Andrew Richardson. And hello, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Great. So you have a radio voice.
Well, you know, some people have told me that before, but when it's not on the microphone, it's a little gruff.
I don't think so. Right. So, on episode 121, your president of the World Sake Import, Chris Pierce, came, and he was such an amazing person.
Oh, yeah, he's a real character.
Right.
You know, he's the first non-Japanese person to bring in premium sake into the United States of America. Mm. And you know, we're a Hawaiian company, so you can use your imagination as to seeing what that is like. It's kind of laid back and relaxed. And Chris is definitely a really interesting individual.
Mm, right. So is that a corporate culture? Somebody is so laid back and fun and relaxed.
Well, you know, we have structure, and we are a company that you know has rules and things, but I wouldn't necessarily say it's a corporate like suit and tie culture, like maybe one of the other Japanese food corporations. Like I don't have, you see me now, I'm not wearing a tie, which I appreciate. Mm. If I have to, I will, but it's not really, you know, corporate America. It's a corporate Hawaii with the Japanese feel.
Mm, right. If you sell good sake with some spirits in it, you don't want to have any corporate structure.
No, I don't think we need it.
Right.
I mean, I think you do need structure, but maybe, you know, within the regulations of making the business operate.
Right. Okay, so let's talk about your background. So I just mentioned you're a relaxed person, and yeah, I heard you were from Canada.
Yeah, yeah. I'm born and raised in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, on the West Coast, or you know, the Western Canada as we call it. Not really the West Coast, but you know, right above Idaho or Spokane, in the right close to the Rocky Mountains. It's a very cold, beautiful country, or part of the country. We're very famous for oil and beef. And timber.
Right.
So, yeah, I grew up there, and then I moved on to Oregon, to the West Coast, and I started my time in the United States in Portland, Oregon.
Nice.
Yeah. Mm. So, and that was a long time ago. Portland has really blossomed into a new, food culture and city.
Mm.
When I was in Portland, I worked in the very first restaurant in the Pearl District. And the Pearl District is kind of like a trendy, you know, kind of hip area of Portland now.
Mm.
And there was somebody that had the vision to open that first restaurant. And it actually led me to some of my first experiences with sake also.
Mm.
The restaurant was a place called Bima, and it was a more of a modern American place. It wasn't a Japanese restaurant. And then afterwards, when they decided to sell the restaurant, they actually sold it to a Japanese corporation.
Mm.
And they opened up a sushi bar, and they brought over all this sake, hand-carried sake, on airplanes, not actually imported.
Wow.
And they had this extensive, or 1.8-liter bottle sake menu.
Mm.
And that was actually my very first, you know, hands-on experience with Japanese sake.
Right. So, by the way, Isshobin is the, you know, like 1,800 milliliters,
yeah,
which is like huge, magnum-sized sake.
Yeah.
But that's the standard in Japan.
This is the standard. You know, this is what I try and explain to my customers, to people that are buying from me. I really push selling the large format bottles in crafts because it maintains the freshness, the taste, the quality.
Mm.
When you're buying a nice little bottle, yes, they're beautiful, they're cute, but you know, you're paying for that packaging.
It's,
if it cuts the cost, you know, 25-30%, so the customer can get it at a better price. Because you know, let's be honest, sake is a little bit expensive because it has to be imported 1 month on a ship, come all the way from Japan. When we import it, in refrigerated containers. When it's in the warehouse, it's refrigerated. From the moment it comes to your front door, it's refrigerated. That's kind of our idea, our policy for World Sake.
Right.
We like to educate, but also we like to have the taste exactly like, or as close to as it can be, coming straight from the brewery in Japan. Mm.
Well, I didn't have any station at the beginning to introduce one of the best sake importers in this country, because I know that that's the philosophy, right?
Mm.
Just the moment the sake bottle left the kura in Japan, you have the same taste. That's the ideal.
This is what we keep a tight inventory. And I mean, this is all nerdy stuff for people that are listening, but we really like to make sure that it tastes the same or as close to as it can as coming from the brewery.
I mean, it's important because
it's very important.
It's like fresh rosé or
yes,
like Beaujolais Nouveau, yep, that kind of idea, right?
Yeah, no, it's definitely, you definitely, with sake, it's a perishable beverage. So if it's kept in improper condition or, you know, not stored properly, it affects the taste.
Mm.
Now, that being said, some sakes, like one of my producers, you know, Tomagawa, which is a gentleman that runs the brewery, or that's the Toji, which is the brewmaster, is named Philip Harper. And he feels that the way that he makes his sake, because he makes it in a very old style, and with the way that he produces the yeast wild in the brewery and all the things that he does that make the sake the way that he wants it, he feels that you can leave his sake unopened on a bar for 6 months and it'll actually taste better. But that is not a normal, you know, idea. When we're talking about, you know, Daewoo Sakura or Masumi or one of these other breweries, they're definitely refrigerated and kept at a lower temperature.
I never heard of that slight aging process as a benefit. Interesting.
Yeah. You know, a brief, quick story, because I can go off on a tangent. But one time I was, you know, Philip Harper came last year it was, and we were cruising around, and when I go to places, I taste with different customers. And so we ran out of the Kincho, which is one of the Daiginjo bottles. So I said, oh my God, what am I going to do? And we're in the middle of our tour of the city. So like, okay, I'm going to go to one of my wine shops. And so I went to the wine shop, and I knew that she had the Kincho, the Daiginjo. And I went in and I was like, okay, thank you. Can I borrow a bottle? Okay, I'll come back and bring it tomorrow. So we took the bottle, went to the next visit. We went to Sake Bar Satsuko's, which is one of the best little hole-in-the-wall sake bars in the city. And we went in and I went to pour the sake, and I looked at it and it was yellow, and I'm like, oh my God, this is a Daiginjo. It's not supposed to be yellow. It's not supposed to be discolored. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. And Philip Harper's watching my face, my facial expressions, and he's like, you know, he's laughing at me because he's like, oh, this is going to be fantastic. This is going to be delicious. Where I'm thinking, oh, it's old, it's spoiled, it's not good. And he was so excited. So needless to say, he was correct, but that is a rare instance.
So we don't know any conditions how aged sake can be actually good or not.
Yeah, it depends on also the way that it's produced in the beginning, right? So he makes sake that he feels can age properly. Huh. So it's a little different. And like, you know, some other breweries will age at -5 degrees Celsius to soften the style of the taste.
Interesting. So I have a couple bottles of sake, and I was waiting for the opportunity to open. It's probably past. Maybe some of them will be again.
You should drink your sake fresh, and I hope it's in the refrigerator.
Okay.
I did have an old bottle for, I think it might have been about 8 or 10 years from Niigata, from the north of Japan. And it came from my grandparents' house, and it was in their cold storage, wasn't in the refrigerator. And then I put it in my refrigerator, and then I opened it, you know, years later, and it was okay. It wasn't bad. You're not going to get sick, but it lost a little bit of its taste.
Interesting. Wow. Okay, so I'll find out. I'll let you know.
Okay, but I'm curious.
Really interesting to, you know, how to theorize what can be aged, what cannot be, and maybe like yeast or koji or those interaction of it.
It's very true.
Right. Yeah. Okay, so but maybe when we come back, we'll discuss that too.
No problem.
Okay, so let's just go back to your, you know, sake history, personal sake history. So you got exposed to that Isshobin, the large bottle.
Exactly.
And so what is your first impression of sake?
Well, my first impression of sake is that it's such a subtle, beautiful taste. So I like a really, you know, floral or aromatic feminine sake. That's what I like. I prefer something that has a nice aroma and nice fragrance. So when I first tasted sake, I was very surprised at how clean the tastes were. And they're really kind of, you know, soft and silky and easy for me to drink. So that's what I like about that's a generalization about sakes, because there's many different varieties and many different styles. Like if you're going to have a Kimoto sake, it's not going to really match up to, well, depends on the Kimoto, match up to like a nice aromatic Ginjo sake, because it's made differently. So that's the thing that people can really learn about sake, is to see the different styles and the ways that they are. It's also a very clean beverage, right? So if I'm only drinking sake and not mixing any other types of alcohol, well, actually, Nihonshu, if I'm drinking Nihonshu, so what we call in Japan sake, or in America sake, then I'm not really going to get any kind of, you know, side effects from it, as long as I'm drinking water and taking care of myself. For me, you know, there's no kojins, there's the impurities, they're not there that are in some other alcohols. So that's another bonus for me, is that I can drink it. Well, I can drink it a lot.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. Just one type of rice, that's rice grape, can be completely different species, varieties. but with rice, although there are different
species. Yeah, there are different varieties of rice, which are really interesting, and they bring different tastes. But it is the thing that I think that is most miraculous about sake and sake production is koji. And I'm sure that you've talked about koji before on your show.
Mm, we get, you know, I had a koji specialist.
Koji is the heartbeat of Japanese cuisine. Mm-hmm. Koji provides us with miso, soy sauce, and sake. So without koji-san, there is no sake.
Right.
And I think that it's really interesting that we can take this you know, organism, and it breaks down the starches into sugars. And if you don't know how sake is made, sake goes through a parallel fermentation. So we actually need to break down the starch into simple sugars in order for the yeast to come in and eat to make the alcohol.
Mm.
So this is an important thing. Without koji, there is no sake. When we have grapes, if we have juice, when we squeeze or crush the grapes, there's naturally occurring sugars in the grapes.
Right.
So that obviously, you know, is easy. You add the yeast and boom. But sake is a little more complicated.
Right. So that's the magic of sake. And it's because the process is similar to beer, but the way the starch is broken down into, you know, the sugar to alcohol and CO2, there are two steps in beer. But in sake, it happens in the same box at the same time.
Parallel fermentation.
Right.
And then, you know, you also, like beer, which is also very similar, the water, right? Without the water, without the Japanese water, you can take the toji, you can take the rice, you can take everything, but it's going to be different because the water content, the minerals in the water are different.
Mm.
So it's very interesting. It's kind of like when you see these advertisements, it's the water, the bagel, New York bagel, right? It's the same kind of concept when you're talking about sake. The water is very, very important.
Mm. Right. So... yeah, I mean, maybe when you come back, maybe talk about more technical things. But, you know, more than wine, grapes are grapes and water is water. I mean, the grape drinks the water from the soil. Mm. But the koji and the yeast and the rice and water, everything's kind of like equally influential.
Yeah, they balance in a nice harmony.
Right. And also toji, the brewer.
Of course.
That's the fifth, probably the most important element.
Definitely. I mean, there's an interesting film on Netflix called The Birth of Sake. And that is one of my breweries from Terigawa, from Ishikawa. And that gives you a very good perspective on how the relationships in the brewery, in the kura, are. So if anybody hasn't seen that, it's worth a gander.
Oh yeah, I was fascinated by the whole story. I'm trying to get Yoshida-san
to
the show, so maybe you can just
bring him. He was very interesting when he came to follow me around, you know, and my colleague here in New York around New York to see the market and how it goes in the summer, and so we had a great time. But we met this director. And then, you know, 2 years go by and it's in the Tribeca Film Festival. So it's really interesting. It's a really interesting perspective, in my opinion.
Right. Okay. All right. So, and I heard that you have a very, very interesting, memorable experience with sake in Kyoto.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, my first experience is in Japan. I went to Japan as a very young man at 20 years old, excuse me. And I was there to help my grandfather and my grandmother. They were there as a guest at Joetsu University in Niigata in the north of Japan.
Hmm.
And so I was there they were there for a prolonged period of time, like 3 months or 4 months, just guests of the government. And my grandfather and the grandmother were older. So I was like, my mother went for a month. I went for a month.
Mm. So she was teaching?
He was teaching. Yeah, he was going around to the different universities to give seminars, to give lectures.
Wow.
Yeah, after he retired. So it was he was an interesting old cat. He's no longer with us.
What was the subject? Am I curious?
He taught industrial arts. Oh. So he was a master cabinet maker. So he taught education and industrial arts.
Interesting. Yeah. Wow.
So my first experience was to go over to help them. And then, of course, when you're young, you got to go off on your own. So, you know, I went to Kyoto and Hiroshima and Tokyo. And when I got to Kyoto, you know, I was thirsty. I'm walking around, looking through the city. And this is before, you know, iPhones or Google Maps or anything like this. You know, I'm walking around, you know, this giant city. Well, not giant, but big city. And I can't read kanji. Can't, you know, speak very much Japanese. Hello, goodbye. You know, things like this. You know, I'm better now, but still not that good. And so I arrived to this, you know, I'm thirsty. I'm looking at the vending machine. I'm like, oh, my God. You know, and in Canada at the time, you know, at 20, you're able to drink at 18 in Canada. So I'm like, I need a beer. So I pull up to the vending machine. I try and get to the beer, and it's not working.
Yeah, that's funny, right? You can buy beer from the vending machine.
From the vending
machine.
It's like
a whole selection of it.
This is what I love. That, and also, if you ever go skiing or snowboarding in Japan, you can buy cans of hot tea or hot coffee at the base of the mountain. I mean, that is luxury,
right? Yeah, and it's like so many options that you can choose.
It's incredible. But my option wasn't working, so this gentleman came out and it, you know, opened up a sliding door, and I literally looked like a table in a room, and there was all these old guys sitting around drinking. And so they said, "Oh, come in." And they said, "Oh, you have a beer." And so I ended up in a little Japanese, you know, pub. And like, not izakaya, like where you're sitting down and it's like, you know, cooking food. Like it's a bunch of old guys sitting around drinking beers. And so I had these, my mother had given me these sumo wrestling stamps, speaking of the sumo stew, right? So they had these sumo wrestling stamps from Canada to give out as gifts. So I said, "Okay, here's a gift. Next thing I know, these guys were ecstatic. They're like, "All right, sake? Nihonshu?" I'm like, sure. And next thing you know, I'm drinking one cups. But these guys, you know, 3-4 hours go by. Man, and I had a rough time trying to find my hotel. You know, I was there until the boss came in a black tinted window car, walked in, looked at me, and I was like, "Okay, I think it's time to go."
Oh my God. Well, this is just memorable. I'm sure that's founded your curiosity too.
Oh, that definitely helped, because the reason why it was important, because it shows the relationship that sake can bring, right? One person in the room spoke a little bit of English. I spoke even less Japanese, and I was there for hours sharing sake with people. So it's about sharing and giving and receiving, you know. So to me, it opened my eyes, and that really kind of helped me to realize what sake was, in my opinion, to be so special, right? So that definitely has it. I have a photo of these gents somewhere, because I had my camera. Wow. Yeah, I'm gonna find it. I'll show you next time I dig. I gotta go digging.
Yeah, maybe we can put it on the show page too.
Yeah, I gotta dig.
Right. Okay. So eventually, you moved to New York, right?
Yeah.
So and that's where you really found Mosake.
Yeah, I moved to New York 15 years ago. I moved to New York in 2003. I had planned to move a little bit before, but obviously it was delayed because of the circumstances that were happening here. I thought I'd give it a little break. I moved from Portland, and I moved originally into Washington Heights. So I pulled up in a minivan into Washington Heights, and had never really been in you know, Upper Manhattan, uptown. And it was a really interesting experience. I moved to New York, and right away I was like, "Okay, I need to get a job." So I looked in the newspaper, for young kids out there, the newspaper, the New York Times, for jobs, help wanted.
Right.
And there, you know, I looked up all these different places, and I kept going around. I was looking for a job as a bartender, because I used to bartend. And I was going around looking at, you know, trying to get these jobs, and nobody would hire me because they wanted New York experience. So this is when I arrived at Geisha. But it wasn't actually called Geisha at the time. It was just an empty restaurant that they were doing construction on. Geisha was a restaurant that was opened by Fabio and Vittorio, the owners that operate Serafina, Italian chain. And they had hired Eric Repair from Le Bernardin to come in and design a French, Japanese menu. And at the time, also the sushi chef that was there was Kazu Yoshida, who now runs Juku. So it was a really interesting mix of people. And, you know, I walked in there and they were saying, "Well, you know, do you have any New York experience?" And I was like, "No, but I speak Japanese fluently." I know everything about sake, and I speak Japanese. And I lied. And the guy said to me, he said, "Oh, well, you know," and I had a goatee at the time, I don't know why. And he said, "Oh, well, you know, if you shave the goatee, I'll give you a job as a busboy." And I was like, "A busboy? I'm going from bartender to busboy?" And I was like, no, I'll shave the goatee if you give me a job as a waiter. And so he gave me the job as a waiter. And in that moment, it helped to bring me down the path to where I am today. Because I really learned a lot about sake in that environment.
Pretending you knew already, but you were learning.
Well, I knew a little bit about sake, but I definitely didn't speak Japanese. Yeah.
But who knows, right? Yeah. We can find out.
The couple Japanese people that worked in the place knew, but they were all right with me.
Right. Okay. So you learned a lot. And so I heard that you met the Masumi Brewery, Miyasaka-san, at the geisha.
Yes, absolutely. You know, so a lot of times World Sake, the company, you know, that I work for, is really keen on doing staff trainings. And so when we have brewery representatives come into town, we like to go into some of the restaurants and train different people and really, you know, kind of talk about what makes sake sake and learn. And Mr. Miyasaka was very enthusiastic about my approach and you know, my love for sake. And so he said, oh, you know, come visit Masumi Brewery.
Mm.
And I was like, okay, I will. Right. And then a year later, I actually contacted World Sake and I said, you know, do you think that you can help me out with visiting the brewery? And they put me in touch with Keith Norum, who works for Masumi. He's the head of international sales and also one of my mentors and great friend. And, he, you know, he said, all right, come. So I went to do two of my favorite things, which
right,
is
what,
to...
Wait. So, but, you know, it was not the... Back then, even now, it's not common to have non-Japanese person working for brewery to oversee the operation, I mean, internationally. So Miyasaka's very open-minded.
Very like
forward-minded.
Yes, absolutely.
Interesting.
100%. One of the premier sake breweries. Yeah, Miyasaka Brewing is called Masumi Brewing on the labels here, unless it's the private label. And there's only one in New York called the Yawaraka. They're very influential sake brewery.
And happen to be World Sake Import's client, which you never knew what's going to happen in your future.
Never. Yeah, I had no idea. Yeah, but they're very important because they founded the number 7 yeast. So there's 18 different base yeasts that we have. And in 1946, Masumi founded the number 7 yeast in the brewery.
The other yeasts are already... you know, in existence, but then Masumi created...
Exactly, in 1946, exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, and so, you know, there's a JSS, there's a Japanese government agency that has and maintains the yeast.
Mm.
And all sake breweries are able to take and use the yeast.
Right.
Right, so they're not proprietary. They can be spread as you wish, as long as you pay
That's
the money for
it. That's crazy democratic.
Isn't it? It is pretty crazy.
Right. Yeah. You almost like a socialist.
Yeah, it's like, okay, we found this delicious yeast. Here you go, everybody. But obviously, in the top breweries, you know, people can manipulate and play with the yeast on their own.
Right. That's where the capitalism come in.
Yes.
Right. Okay. So you went to Japan with Masumi.
Yes. Yeah, I went to the north first, to Hokkaido, and I did some snowboarding in the north and ate some delicious seafood. And actually, all of the food in Hokkaido is absolutely out of this world. Some of the best I've actually eaten. I was very fortunate. I'll be quick because I know we're short on time and I can just talk.
I know. I'm controlling time, so don't worry about that.
So, yeah, no, I went to Hokkaido and I picked randomly on the screen, pointed at the place where I was going to stay, this guest house in the Japanese tourist information. And it turned out it was a young gentleman that studied in Canada to make craft beers. So I ended up in this guest house where the mother liked to make French cuisine for the set menu. And I was drinking his unlimited craft beers for the local Niseko Brewing Company. And now they've actually grown. I've looked into it. I'd like to go back, but they've actually grown into a tap house. So the guest house that I stayed in is actually an actual tap house in Niseko in Hokkaido.
Interesting.
Which is really kind of interesting.
Right. Yeah. Maybe if you know someone that you can bring in the guest.
I would love to. get them on. I think the English is tight.
Oh, you can translate for them.
Okay.
Right. All right. So then you went to Japan and after the Hokkaido. And so you learned a lot about the Miyasaka Shizo. Maybe that's how you got more into sake.
Yeah, definitely. There's some of the most influential breweries for me to learn from were Miyasaka number one, and also Dewazakura from Yamagata. Also Komoizumi, also Sohomari. Like, there's certain breweries that I went to where I really learned a lot from the producers. You know. And also Hoyo, you know, there's a few. It's hard to list them all because you learn different things from different people. And that's what separates the sake also, is the character of the people really defines the taste of the sake. So, you know, when you have Komurizumi, for example, this is a, you know, this is a non-charcoal filtered, you know, a little bit more character, a little bit more pizzazz, just like the owner.
I actually visited the brewery.
Oh, nice. Yes.
And I heard it takes 15 years from the top of the mountain for the water to get to their well.
Yeah. You know, I don't quote me on that, but I think you're right. Mm. Yeah, I believe it. Yeah, it's you know, Saijo is such a remarkable city.
Right.
You know, if anybody ever has a chance to go visit a sake town or a real sake town outside of Hiroshima, it's called Saijo. And there's, I believe there's 15 different breweries there.
I heard you say back then was like 33 or something.
Oh, really?
It's maybe less now.
Maybe I'm wrong. No, I could be wrong.
No, it was a while ago, so.
Okay, yeah.
Now we have to say breweries there.
There's a remarkable amount of breweries in Saijo, Hiroshima.
Even if it's a very compact, small area, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so, and then you came back to New York.
Yeah.
And you kind of left the world of Japan for a while.
I did, yeah. You know, I left and I, this is where we first met, is at a place called Pareja.
Mm.
And that was Michael Simon was the chef that was running, it was his restaurant, but also Jonathan Sawyer was running the kitchen there.
Right, now he's in Cleveland.
Yeah, he's back in Cleveland. I haven't seen him in years, but...
He won the James Beard Awards.
Oh, did he?
Yeah.
Oh, good for him.
He's amazing.
Oh, yeah. He's a very talented chef. Yeah, all the whole crew from Pareja, that was an excellent restaurant. It was sad that it didn't really, you know, pick it up. It was excellent Greek food. Michael Simon, I think if he was on the TV like he is now, then I think Pareja would have been a whole different beast.
Mm.
I think it was just a little bit before its time.
Right.
You know, so that was an interesting place. And then I moved on from there. I gave it one year to kick at the can there. And then I moved on to WD-50.
Mm. So that is unfortunately it's closed, but, you know, molecular influence with the...
Well, you know, the chef wouldn't use that term.
I know. Nobody does.
Yeah. He, you know, it was a good example of avant-garde food. You know, some of the techniques could be classic Japanese, classic French, but put together and assembled in a creative and fun different way to see food or taste food. You know, there were some dishes that really, really excelled, and then there were some that maybe some people didn't like, and that was the whole point, you know.
Mm.
When we got re-reviewed, Frank Bruni came in, and I had no idea that I was serving him. And, you know, I came into the shift the next day, and one of my coworkers was like, "Oh, I hope you did a good job last night." I was like, "Well, what do you mean?" And he's like, "Well, Sir Frank Bruni, we're getting re-reviewed." I'm like, "Oh no, I really hope I had a good table with him."
Yeah.
But no, one of the things that I said actually that was mentioned about the restaurant is that if you don't like the food, you know, this creative, fun kind of impression or chef's example of the food, you can walk down to Fly, which is no longer there, or you can walk, you know, to wherever other classic place and get that style of food.
Right.
So it was a really unique, excellent place, and then it also really helped me to grow and learn about wines and also with sake. It was incredible because we were doing one of the first to pair sake with some.
I was so impressed. So you were behind it.
Yeah, I was one of the. I was definitely one of the people. Dewey Dufresne, Chris Clark, one of the old managers, Jeffrey Fisher. There was Tona Palomino. Tona Palomino now works in Chicago for another sake company.
Mm.
You know, like the web of people that put their influence on the restaurant was very important.
Mm. Yeah, that's important, you know, just for the sake history in America. You know, French restaurants, Jean Georges to per se, those places started to pay attention to sake. And like WD-50, they deconstruct and reconstruct. But I think, in my opinion, through the process, more flavor elements are more distinctive.
Mm.
So you can pair sake or wine, probably in more challenging way, but more interesting, you know, of thinking.
We definitely, I mean, like one of the, I mean, there's numerous pairings that were phenomenal, but there was a foie gras dish with on pea soil. It was a dehydrated pea, like crusted flour with beet filling, and that paired with sake that was out of this world. It was the Miyasaka Yamahai 50, which we no longer make or bring back into the States, but it was it was definitely, and that was actually Glennie Goodwin, who is back in Australia now, doing, he was at the Bentley Bar, but I think he's doing their new project. I think I think he's part owner of their new project. And that's another famous, you know, Australian restaurant. But back to even the sake with pairing of food, like Fat Duck, we're talking about Musumi. The Musumi Nanago, the Fat Duck pairs the Musumi Nanago more than in almost any other restaurant. Like there are non-Japanese restaurants that are opening their eyes to see that sake is made from rice and it pairs perfectly with food.
Right, because it doesn't challenge. I think wine is great, but you know sometimes acidity or the tannins kind of counterbalance the.
Yeah, I mean you take like artichoke. This is a very hard thing to pair with wine. Okay, you take the artichoke, you take it with some sake. I can tell you what sake I can pair it with. You know, maybe you have a nice glass of anise since we're here in Roberto's. Roberto's, we could have that, but like. I know a good sake that would pair with
right. So in other words, you know, like if the tannins are so strong, there's no steak. Somewhere in between or something tricky, sake can fill
absolutely
the gap. Right. So yeah.
In my opinion, sake can pair with anything. So like I'm seeing the people through the window here eating the pizza, and I'm thinking to myself, maybe the Sohamari Kimoto. This would be delicious.
Right.
You know.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, I'm a fan of sake. Sake with barbecue, absolutely. Sake with steak, absolutely.
And cheese,
of course. Yeah, it's one of the weirdest. Back in the day, in Bozu, on Grand Street in Williamsburg, Shinji who now owns 108 Ichikobachka, he did a cheese and sake pairing flight, and he had put it was a Valderone blue cheese, Spanish blue cheese, with Komuzumi Nigori, back to the Saijoke sake. And man, I would have never imagined that it would be so good. It was phenomenal.
Sounds like there's no never-ending discoveries of pairings.
I agree.
Right. So, so you happened to join the World Sake Imports, which actually you founded in 1998, so it's a great history. So... So you met someone who was quitting World Sake Import for personal reasons.
Yeah, no, she was moving on to open up the World Sake office in London. Asami Lewis.
Right, yeah. So that's how you got into...
Yeah, well, she came in randomly because she was the sales rep in WD-50. Mm. And she came into WD-50 and she said, oh my God, I'm going to open up the London office in 2 weeks and I've got nobody. But because I was fortunate enough to be invited by Mr. Miyasaka and took my own time to go and enjoy the seafood in Hokkaido.
It's interesting, right? Like how one piece unfolds to the next.
Yeah,
it's almost even like, you know, WD-50, you never expected to be working with a Japanese.
You gotta follow your interests. I think that's how I try and live my life.
Okay, and now you are responsible for many accounts. I think there are about 70 restaurants in New York City.
Oh, yeah.
To take care of restaurants,
yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Right. So now you have just under $1 million sake.
Yeah,
in the market.
I sell about $1 million of sake a year, which is a big change from the beginning when I was selling 300,000, you know. So the right around, if you look right around here, you know, you got Momo Sushi Shack right behind us. They buy a lot of really good sake. You know, I sell to all different types of places. Some of my favorite places, you know, Decibel. It's not really refined, but you get a great feel for, you know, an old sake bar. You go downstairs.
Well, that's important, right? Because sake started like, you know, say, like noble, fancy restaurants. And now it's created a good image of sake. But now it's like sushi at the supermarket, decent sushi. And it's like, you know, sake, it's becoming for everybody's.
I really hope so. And I see it going in that way. I mean, if you're going to go for a nice expensive dinner, you can still have delicious sake. But I like, you know, Karasu in Brooklyn. This is an interesting, cool place. You know, Tetsue, which is now turned into sushi, which is by the Nomad Hotel. That's kind of more upscale. Like I have eclectic taste in where to consume my sake.
Right. Well, maybe I can do the pairing guide.
Yeah.
Episode next time.
Yeah, no problem. I love to do that.
Right. Okay, so let's take a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll talk about Andrew's favorite sake breweries, so please stay with us.
Today's program is brought to you by Korin, a supplier of Japanese chef knives and restaurant supplies. Korin is proud of their Japanese culture and traditions, but they want you to know that their products are not just for Japanese restaurants. Their knives and tableware bring out the best qualities of food from every culture and fit into every restaurant from French to Pan-Asian to American. And that is why they're located in New York City, where people from every country in the world come to eat. Korin's Tribeca showroom is home to the most extensive collection of Japanese chef knives in the world, including Japan. Stop by to view their exquisitely designed tableware and the rarest natural sharpening stones. They have a whole range of knife services, from repair and rust removal to reshaping and realigning. Korin is dedicated to this ideal, bringing the highest quality Japanese design to your table so you can experience the unparalleled quality of Japanese craftsmanship in your home or restaurant. For more information, visit Korin.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Japan Eats, broadcast live from your studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, and my guest today is Andrew Richardson, who has worked at the World Sake Imports, one of the greatest sake importers in the U.S., for past 11 years. So you have a lot of sake breweries to work with at the World Sake Imports. So, and you mentioned Miyasaka Shuzo many times. I love their sake. And by the way, Kamoizumi, you know, the saijo. I just heard that the fourth generation, the third generation, Toshio Maegaki, he just got the medal of honor by the emperor.
Yes. Right? Yes. It was incredible. I see the news on Facebook, and I'm like, wow. He deserves it.
Right, because, Hiroshima sake, I mean, the sake is so regional that it's hard to be recognized, but he works so hard to name.
He is one of my favorite characters. Maegaki Sacho he likes to climb mountains. He's very fun and charismatic and, you know, boisterous, but in a good way. So yeah, I'm really proud to see that he got that recognition, and he really deserves it. You know, they really do a lot of good,
right,
for sake.
And the sake is delicious.
It is delicious.
Right.
You can't get a better warm sake. You know, sometimes people say, oh, warm sake is bad sake. Well, that's a misconception. When you're in Japan and there's no central heating and it's cold, you know, a warm sake is really good when it's delicious warm sake. If you're getting a box of sake that's produced in a factory, you know, in California or even in the outskirts of some big city in Japan, it's a different product than a handmade boutique, warm sake.
Right. Okay. So we talked about Tedorigawa. That's a movie. So maybe you can just talk about another.
Yeah, Koshi no Kombai. You know, this is a very famous brewery from Niigata, from the north of Japan. And I, like I explained, you know, the first time that I went to Japan was in the north, in Joetsu, in Niigata. So this is the region that I spent the most time in my first visit. I've been, you know, numerous times since then. But man, Niigata sake is just really clean, crisp, you know, dry, nice, easy drinking sake. And Koshi no Kombai is really instrumental or important in making that taste. In 1970, they helped to shape the entire taste for the region.
Niigata Tanle. Tanle is light and clean,
exactly,
and crisp.
Yeah, and so, you know, you might be familiar with Kubota or Hakaisan or one of these other really good breweries from the north, or, you know, numerous other ones. And matter of fact, actually, the reason why Niigata is considered to make some of the best sake is because they have more producers, sake breweries, than any other prefecture. So there's a very famous, you know, it's very famous in Niigata because they have more breweries than everywhere else.
It's now over 100 or 93 or something like really ridiculous concentration.
Yes, they have a lot of producers.
Right, and there is a two-day event in March.
This is one of my needs. I need to go to that. It's not a want, it's a need. I have to go visit that.
Right.
Also the Saijo Sake Fest. These are two journeys that I need to make back to Japan.
Right. Okay. And, right. So I'm curious. I heard there is an event in New York by the Miyasaka Brewery.
Yes. You know, we're doing a really fun, kind of interesting event on November 13th. And it's going to be 6 p.m. till close at Ivan Ramen. And the idea behind the event is that we're doing a sake sampler from Misumi, from Miyasaka Brewing. And we have a brewery from St. Louis, Urban Chestnut. Urban Chestnut is a really good small producer from St. Louis. And what happened was Katsuhiku Miyasaka, the next boss of the Misumi Brewery, had gone to St. Louis and had met the brewery. And there are sister cities, St. Louis and Suwa, where Misumi is located in Nagano. And so basically they made friends, and he sent over a little small sample of the number 7 yeast, and this brewery made Konami beer, which is made with the number 7 Misumi yeast. Mm. And so we're going to have some of the beer on tap with the sake sampler and, you know, obviously delicious food from Ivan Ramen. It's highly, highly recommended that you make reservations if you're interested in coming. We're going to have both, you know, brewmasters, both Tojis that are going to be there. And it'll just be a really fun, easygoing experience. Mm. Drinking sake, having beer, eating food.
Right. Interesting. Well, I just had a lucky job to moderate an event about craft beer and the sake collaboration.
Nice.
And I learned so much because of, you know, the common elements like yeast and the koji. They can, because of the similarity of the fermentation process, beer and sake, it's so many, like, there's an opportunity. Crazy ideas.
It is. You know, it's really interesting that they really, like, people call, you know, the misconception is that sake is called rice wine. It's actually closer to a beer. So this is a, you know, this is what's kind of cool. It's a delicious rice beverage.
Mm. Right. So I think if you're a brewer on which side, sake or beer, it's an inspiration, right? Because you're always looking for new flavors. And sake yeast and the beer yeast, I'm not sure how common they can be, but yeast is yeast. It can be, you know, in the air or anywhere.
Yeah,
so
there's definitely yeast in the air. You know, that's the thing. When you go into the sake brewery, you have to wash your hands with alcohol, put your boots on, put a lab coat on, put, looks like, a shower cap on, just so that no wild yeast intermix with
the... Right. And I heard that those sensitive fermentation environment, you're not allowed to eat the natto, which is such a strong yeast and bacteria.
No good.
Right. Anyways, but natto is good to protect your guts.
Yeah, so. Immune system. It's natto is delicious. Sometimes it's a little rough. Depends on the natto.
Yeah, but I know good brands. So,
I bet.
Yeah.
For me, it's pick and choose.
Right. Well, it's what really represent Japanese fermentation culture.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, at Yoporai, in right around the corner from where WD-50 was, they make their own natto.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Or they used to. I haven't been there to taste it recently, but.
Interesting.
Yeah, they used to make really good natto.
Right. Well, I heard it's not as hard as people would think.
Yeah, I've never made it, so I'd have to, you know, not say I don't know.
We'll see. Okay, so you are not just knowledgeable and experienced in the sake business, but also your life, whole life, seems to be devoted to sake. So what is your mission and goals?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I've been thinking about that. And I guess at this point, it's really to try and teach people about sake and trying to share with everybody, not just Japanese culture, what sake is. Excuse me. So yeah, that's really kind of where I'm going with that. And then also, of course, I need to sell sake because that's what I do.
Right. Well, I think they're not separate, right?
No. I think that the way that my outlook is that with education, sake sells.
Mm.
So I really enjoy to educate people about selling sake. I consider myself an educator as much as a salesperson. Right. But also I really enjoy to help dissect and create lists and do things like this. Because it's really interesting to try and, even if it's not my sake from my importer, I like to see what other people have and try and mix and help to make a really balanced list. I really enjoy that. That's probably one of my favorite parts of the job.
Right.
When I'm able to help with that, I really enjoy that moment.
Right. The one thing, we talked about the wine and beer industries, but, you know, when it comes to sake industry, like, traditionally they have seasonal. They don't operate throughout.
Exactly.
You know, like in the factory.
No.
So the workers are seasonal. and farmers as well in season. And you really have that cultural background, including the human beings.
So. Yeah. You know, the thing that I think that's interesting, and I say this sometimes in my trainings, is that sake is this really old, spiritual, beautiful beverage, okay, that's used in weddings and ceremonies, and it's really important. You know, there's a shrine in each brewery, but then it's also the mixture of this, like, Sony and, like, you know, modern technology. So it's a combination at this point in this little area of time where it's this old Buddhist beverage intermixed with, like, PlayStation. Mm. You know, like, it mixes old traditions and ideas and principles with this, you know, a machine that can polish a piece of rice to 30%, you know. So it really mixes. I think it really is a good definition of Japanese society,
right?
In a way,
It's kind of minimalist idea, right? Like, you really, you know, cut down to whatever you cannot replace with machine. You just have, like, it depends on the brewery, but, you know, the way you sprinkle koji over, you know, the rice.
Exactly. Yeah, there's so many different variables within the production aspect of what makes sake unique. Also, it's hard. It's like, you know, somebody might say, oh, well, you know, this is a junmai, or this is a junmai ginjo, or this is a junmai dai ginjo. But there's so many different things. There's the rice, there's the way they polish it, whether they add alcohol to it, or whether they, you know, pasteurize it. It's very unique. You know, it's a very cool beverage. And I think that maybe some people might say, oh, well, like, I just had a friend that was in from France, and they're from the south of France, and so they're very familiar with wine. Mm. But he'd never had this type of sake.
Mm.
And I gave him several varieties of the sake, and I could see that he was, from my perception, that he thought they were very similar. So, you know, it sometimes it takes a little bit more of tasting something for your mouth to really register and appreciate it.
Right.
And even with very umami rich sakes, you know, sometimes you taste that first sip and you're like, woo, what's this? And then, like, it takes you a little while to adjust to that taste, you know, and get to that next, you know, area of enjoyment.
Right. And also, you know, someone like you can tell the stories. And I think any, you know, there's thousands of drinks and food and to choose from, but you need a story, right?
I agree. I mean, and every time I go to Japan, or every time the Japanese brewers come over here, I got stories, because we have interesting times together drinking sake. And I think that's really a fundamental part of sake, is the story.
Right. Yeah, so when you have a sip of something and you have some memories with it, or some episodes, then you appreciate, like, 1,000 times more.
1,000 times more.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I've got fond memories of Buckfast in Glasgow. I've got fond memories of sake, you know, in Kyoto. I've got fond memories of sherry in Spain. I've got rosé memories in the south of France. The story from the experience that you share with the people really helps to grow the taste.
Right. And the operating sake breweries, they say it's around only 1,000, which is declining so fast.
It's declining very quickly.
Right. So
yeah, it's really it's really a shame. It's a hard labor intensive, you know, production, and it's very unfortunate.
Right, because again, you cannot operate throughout the year with machines, so. This is something really precious.
Even if you look at the rice, the production of the rice,
you
know, I think that this year will be an interesting year to see how the sake tastes, because of all the problems with the hot weather and the storms in Japan this last year. It'll be interesting to see what product people produce.
Right.
You know, because the rice is going to be maybe have some problems.
Mm.
Maybe. Mm. Maybe I'm wrong. I gotta ask a toji on that one.
Yeah, we'll see. All right, so for listeners who are interested in pursuing their career in the sake industry, what's the best way to study sake and learn about sake?
Well, first and foremost is to drink it. To drink and see what you like. And then to drink some of the sakes that you don't like. So you can figure out why you maybe don't like something. And then, I guess, I mean, I followed my path through working in restaurants. You know, I've always been in the service side of restaurants. So that's how I did it. You know, I would say, you know, Jamie Graves, I think he was on your show before.
Yep.
You know, he came from the service side. You know, he used to manage some great places, and he's moved on for Skernick Wines now. Yeah, I think that maybe following through the service industry is the first start.
Because you have a free exposure in a way.
Exactly. And right. Background, and you also get educated. You know, in the caliber of places that we've worked in, I learned more about food than I would have in probably most schools.
Right. So someone like you training people at the restaurants too, so.
Oh yeah, I love to train. Anytime.
Okay, so where can we find your update online?
That's a very good question. I'm on Instagram at Sake Yakuza. I know. Okay. That, some people are like, what? But yeah, other than that, I'm not a big social media guy.
Okay.
Yeah, I kind of just and myself and roll around.
Oh, maybe the Waldosek Imports website.
Yeah, you can always find me there, of course.
So what's the address?
It's World Sake. It's www.worldsake.com.
Okay. So either way, or both ways, we'll find you.
Yes.
Okay. So thank you so much for joining us today.
No problem.
Yeah, hopefully you're going to come back.
Anytime. Thank you very much. It was a great conversation, and I could always talk to you.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. So listeners, if you have any questions or comments about the show or suggestions for show topics or guests, please contact us at japaneats@heritageradionetwork.org or kikukatayama.com. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify as a podcast. And engineer is Jeet Paul, and thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.